The following episode was recorded in front of a live audience at Spring Studios in New York City. The event also featured music by Lucy Kalantari, whose music is featured at the beginning and end of each commercial break. You can hear more from Lucy at lucykalantari.com. And now, enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Fashion Is Your Business Live. This one recording on location from the incredible and beautiful New York pop-up restaurant Caviar Caspia at Spring Place. And we call it FIYB Live because we happen to be in front of a live studio audience. They are alive, that is for sure. Thank you very, very much, everybody. And this is very exciting. We have a very impressive guest for you today. Our guest is none other than Aliza Licht, who is a fashion industry veteran and the author of the best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. She's currently the Executive VP of Brand Marketing and Communications at Alice and Olivia by Stacey Bendett. Aliza was formerly the longtime SVP of Global Communications for Donna Karan International, was responsible for overseeing the worldwide strategy. What's her secret sauce? Incorporating innovation into a traditional landscape of digital communication. Now, Aliza's most known for her work as the former voice of DKNY PR Girl, an award-winning Twitter personality that she created. And Aliza is widely credited as a social media pioneer in the fashion industry, building a community of over 1.5 million followers for DKNY. Her ability to speak to a new audience with a digital mindset captivated customers and followers worldwide, and her true identity as the voice behind DKNY PR Girls was kept anonymous for 2 years until Aliza revealed herself and when her story was chronicled by the New York Times. And we're going to find out what's happened since then right here on Fashion Is Your Business Live when we continue, because guess what? The show starts right now.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm Aliza Licht, and I'm the Executive Vice President of Brand Marketing and Communications for Alice and Olivia by Stacey Bendett, and also the author of Leave Your Mark. And I love fashion tech because you can make mistakes and people think you're brilliant because you were first.
From the fashion tech capital of the world, New York City, this is Fashion Is Your Business, the leading podcast at the intersection of fashion, tech, and business, produced by Mouth Media Network, with Pavan Bal, co-creator of the Global Fashion Battle and founder of Open Source Fashion, Rob Sanchez, business strategist and 2016 Fashion Fellow, and Mark Rako, award-winning creative entrepreneur. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Welcome to Fashion Is Your Business Live on location from the incredible New York pop-up restaurant Caviar Caspia at Spring Place. I'm one of your hosts, Mark Rako, and directly across from me, pretty far because it's a long table, but I can still see him, Mr. Pavan Bal. How are you, Pavan?
Hey, you.
Hey,
very
Pavan.
Well.
And to my right, it's not my right, it's my left. I'm all turned around because you're so handsome, Rob, Mr. Rob Sanchez.
Hey, y'all.
Hey, Rob. Make you uncomfortable or?
No. Okay. I know I'm handsome.
Okay.
Thank you.
And also joining us on the mic pleasure, really, is a friend to the show and a friend of ours, Jackie Trevelcock. She is the managing director of the New York Fashion Tech Lab. Jackie, welcome again to the mic. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And, of course, our guest, as we mentioned before, is none other than the incredible Aliza Licht, who is, of course, the executive VP of Brand Marketing and Communications at Alice and Olivia by Stacey Bendett. Aliza, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're really pleased to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So let's start out like we always do on this show, which is to ask you to provide us with a kind of Reader's Digest thumbnail sketch of who you are and what you do.
Who I am and what I do. Well, I am a 20-year fashion veteran. I started in the business on the magazine side in editorial and then jumped to PR probably before any of you were born in the late 90s and really kind of grew up in communications and marketing. And since then, I've sort of plowed through many, many years and authored a book, my first and last book, Leave Your Mark, which came out in 2015 and was pretty much the same thing as giving birth. So I'm done. One and done. Although I do have two kids.
Okay, we're going to find out what you do both, I guess, when your two kids are around and when they're not. In a few minutes when we dive a lot deeper. But for now, just a quick bit of housekeeping, a reminder to all of our listeners, would you kindly follow us on social media, by the way, at Fashion Biz Show. That's Fashion B-I-Z Show. You can also find all of our episodes, past, present, and future, at our very own website, fashionisyourbusiness.com, as well as on iTunes and Google Play. And you can find all of the other Mouth Media Network shows, from beauty to fashion to fitness to spirituality, travel, you name it. We've got a lot more coming. All of that at mouthmedianetwork.com. All right, let's start. So I'm going to lead this off with a question. I happen to know, as I'm sure a lot of other people do, that you have a degree in neurobiology and physiology. And you got that degree with a full academic merit scholarship. That sounds pretty committed to me. So my question is, tell us about the bridge that was built between that reality and working as an assistant accessories editor for Marie Claire magazine.
That doesn't connect.
Yeah.
So I grew up with fashion magazines all over my walls, like I'm sure many people in this room did. And, you know, back then, just an 80s kid, no one explained to you all the options that were in the world as far as your jobs. It was basically lawyer, doctor, teacher. So I never contemplated how those magazines got made, and no one told me. So they just became wallpaper. And I was very good in science in school, and I was also very artistic. So as one does, I thought, oh, I'll be a plastic surgeon.
Mm.
So I interned. I really actually would be psyched if I was a plastic surgeon right now in my fourth decade. But back then, I interned for a plastic surgeon for like 3 years of my high school, and I loved it. And it was extremely, it was an extremely fake view of what it would be like, because it was ambulatory surgeries. It was in this beautiful little white picket fenced house. It was especially fun when I would see people I know on the table and they were asleep and didn't know I was there and I was assisting. And I'd be like, oh, she's getting a nose job. And I would call my mom and be like, guess who was in today? And it was all very packaged perfectly. And then I went off to college thinking this is what I'm going to do. And I was all set. And I was, you know, very, very determined. And of course, my parents were very proud and told God knows how many people that their daughter was going to be a plastic surgeon. I did an internship in college to simulate what it would be like to really be, you know, a medical student. And it was ER shifts and it was the whole nine yards. And at the time, my grandmother was living with us and she unfortunately was on her last days. And between my grandmother and what I was seeing in the hospital, it all seemed really depressing to me. And I'm pretty much an upbeat, happy person every day. And I just felt like, is this going to be my everyday situation where I'm going to go in and I'm going to see people suffering? And then on the superficial side, I was like, I cannot wear scrubs and I cannot wear rubber clogs. And also I wear red lipstick and I cannot wear a face mask. And by the way, your mic is going to have red lipstick all over it by the end of tonight.
No problem. That's how we
prefer. No problem. It's fashion.
So, you know, in combination, I started to feel like, what the hell am I doing? And I was in college one day and literally, if anyone has seen Model's Manual by Arthur Elgort, fashion photographer, I'm sure most of you know him. It was a book that I bought in high school and that I followed intensely. And I was just looking through it and it was truly an epiphany of me thinking like, oh my God, duh, I want to work in fashion. So I called up my parents and I was like, just kidding. And by that point, it was too late to change majors. So I had to finish out neurobiology and physiology, which was really fun. And then I decided when everyone went abroad after college, I needed to buckle down. And I stayed back by myself and I landed at Harper's Bazaar.
All I got out of that really stuck to is that you had internships in high school. That's insanely ambitious.
Self-made. They didn't count for anything,
right?
No. I get that. Actually, zero.
Yeah. So that's really how it happened.
All right. So you didn't use any of the neurobiology inside of what you did with, whether it's Marie Claire or going on to DKNY PR Girl. Was there any inspiration that you took from your learnings there?
Honestly,
to translate
work ethic.
Yeah.
Because I think if you're pre-med, and by the way, I took my MCATs. So
yeah.
I had
you really
to do the whole, it was too far gone. So I think work ethic, and it's one of the real principles in my book because, you know, I've obviously hired a ton of people over the course of 20 years. And just as every year passes, work ethic gets diluted more and more. So I think, you know, when you have to really wake up every day and have 8 a.m. labs and you know, you're plowing through organic chemistry and it's intense, you learn how to really manage your time and really kind of work your ass off, really. So I took that to fashion. And in fashion, I found that there is a lot of the same mentality. You know, the people who are successful in fashion, they are 24/7. They do not stop at anything to get stuff done. So I think it actually worked very well when I transferred over.
And was that a catalyst for the book? Is kind of you seeing the decline in the work ethic?
Seeing the decline in the work ethic, seeing people emailing me like as if they're texting me, seeing, you know, interns of ours who would look at me like, why was I asking them to do that? Or like, you know, what was in it for them? And I think, you know, if you've come up in fashion, and I did go through the ranks as an assistant, as an intern, as an assistant, and on, you know, you pay your dues. And there used to be this mentality of paying your dues, and somehow it's completely dissipated. So I'd like to bring that back tonight. Can we tell everyone?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you
recently published an article that was just about like the power of just saying yes. Just say yes to whatever task that comes. Take a beat, like analyze whether you could do it or not before your immediate knee jerk is no.
Yes.
I think that's a really powerful, resonating message, and I hope so.
I hope so too. I mean, people like to hear yes.
For sure. So let's take it from I don't want to go too deep into DKNY PR Girl. I mean, everyone knows it's well documented, the work that you've done there. Really out of the box at the time, forged a communication very successfully for a brand, and now you're working as a communication director for a brand. So I want to kind of see that now your lens is being kind of forward thinking in this digital arena, what you're using, what you're doing, how you're viewing it as a brand voice versus Aliza's voice or DKNY PR Girl's voice.
I mean, it's very different. I think, you know, when I started DKNY PR Girl in 2009, first of all, no one was...
How many people were on Twitter? Like
zero.
Overall?
Really
no
early,
fashion
yeah.
brands.
Yeah.
No one knew what to do, really.
No one. And that is why I think if you are fearless and you're not afraid to make mistakes, which is how I started this conversation, you can really, you know, plow ahead of the curve by sort of not caring if you mess up. And I think my mentality, because I was at Donna Karan for so many years and I did have the trust of management, I wasn't scared to make mistakes because I knew if it was like a gut intuitive move and I felt good about it, that they would support me. So that's sort of how I, you know, sort of set my mind with that is just no fear while at the same time always keeping the lens of a publicist. So what are those sound bites? Mm-hmm. What am I talking about? What is brand appropriate?
You were managing a conversation which at the time seemed manageable. Now where you have, what is it, 50-something million Twitter users? You're working with a brand that probably is inundated with various types of communication inbounds. And I'm wondering how you're handling all of that or how your team is handling all of that in an organized and targeted fashion.
You're right. It's very different. And I think back then, you could manage it. I did it all by myself in real time. No content calendars, no Hootsuite, TweetDeck, just to see my columns.
Also, Twitter is a place where people vent their shit. Like, they're not reaching you because they're like, oh my God. Well, sometimes they love you.
Trust me, I am so skilled in crisis management. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is not cute. It is not cute because also it's personal. Like, it was...
Can you talk about some of the digital solutions or process that you put in place to help manage this?
I think every brand should have really clear social media guidelines on their platform. So if you don't have it on your Facebook page, for example, it's something you should have. You reserve the right to delete and reject comments that do not fit within your brand guidelines. You know, we learned the hard way back in the day by not having that in place, because then you start to get into a situation when you've seen many brands do this, they just start to panic and delete everything. And that's not a strategy either. But if you can say with confidence, like, this is, we have house rules.
Yeah.
Like, this is our house and we have house mm-hmm. rules, just like take off your shoes when you come in my door. Those are the house rules for social media.
Do you take off your shoes when you go into
your
door?
I do not. Because shoes are important to my look and I can't do it another way. But people do.
Hey, I don't impose it on other people, but I take off my shoes when I walk in the door.
Exactly. So I think back then, you know, it was the Wild West a little bit more so than it is now. I also think building community back then was a lot easier than it is now. The algorithms were working against you, as we all know. So different, you know, I just started at Alice and Olivia, and it's very different because Donna Karan was the voice of Donna Karan Collection. Or Donna Karan New York, as we call it formally, and DKNY didn't really have a voice. So she really wanted to focus on the luxury part of the business. So there was a void that essentially DKNY PR Girl filled. Very different at Alice and Olivia. Stacey Bendett is the brand. She is the voice.
It is for sure.
Amazingly luxurious to have someone that you are so clear about their vision and what they stand for, that it makes the social strategy totally, totally different. So Stacey does the Instagram herself. I mean, that is purely her. And everything else we sort of just build, and we are in the process actually of hiring a new social media manager, if anyone knows anyone, to really sort of build the content, sort of, I guess, amplify her vision and her voice across every single other platform at this point.
How's your team actually monitoring success? Like, how do you gauge success right now?
When I hire my team, I'll let you know that answer.
How do you? All right. So how does the company overall gauge success on communication? Like, I mean, are you looking at conversion metrics? Or are you just looking at pure engagement and branding?
No, we are looking at conversion metrics. But first and foremost, and I will say this, and I've always been a proponent of this: engagement, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, and I challenge any of you to go pick a brand, any brand you want, look at their community, take any post and figure out that engagement metric, and you will be floored at how small it is. Mm. So
how's Alice and Olivia's?
It's actually really high on Instagram.
Okay.
It is.
Instagram's your playpen?
Well, that's really Stacey's baby.
Okay.
So she does an incredible job on it, and it's all in real time, and it's all her all the time. And I think that people feel the authenticity of that, mm-hmm. just like they did when I did DKNY PR Girl, because everyone kind of knew it was always me in real time, and you were getting, you know.
Yeah, people can tell if it's real.
Yeah, you can tell.
Are you testing out social commerce on Instagram or anywhere else?
We're going to be doing a lot of testing. We are like plowing full steam ahead.
What are you using for that?
We're in conversations. Can't say it yet because contract's not signed, but we are all about testing, innovation, tying commerce to social, because I mean, honestly, that's where we all have to be.
Yeah.
What type of solutions overall? So you don't have to say specifically whom you're working with, but what types of arenas of technology are you excited about for digital?
I'm excited about companies that are all inclusive. So I don't want 10 different vendors for solutions. I want one that mm-hmm. does everything, and they exist.
Sure.
They're very expensive, but they exist. And I think that also when you partner with someone that offers kind of the Chinese menu of everything you need, you can really take a deep dive from a strategic standpoint in having them understand your mission and goals and what you ultimately want to do, rather than, you know, this vendor owns this one piece of what you're doing and this vendor owns another. I mean, I feel like that doesn't work anymore.
I
feel like we're way beyond
this,
that.
But I recently found out that, or was told, that every Chinese menu in America is printed by one printer, by one family of printers. But think
Seems
about
impossible.
It. They all look the same.
I hope
same.
You guys are tweeting that. That is really the smartest thing I've heard tonight.
Look at, I mean, there's uncanny resemblance between one in California,
don't you think there's
in
like a format?
Michigan, or New York.
A suggested font?
Or the font.
Or like a type size? I mean, like.
I don't know.
I think I could fake that. I think I can do it.
I'm just saying, it was something I was told. I didn't fact check it.
Talk about a first mover advantage.
Exactly. Just hold it down.
All right. That may be a perfect point for a quick break. And when we come back, of course, much more with Aliza Licht, the Executive VP of Brand Marketing and Communications at Alice and Olivia by Stacey Bennett, right here at the incredible and beautiful New York pop-up restaurant Caviar and Caspia at Spring Place. We will be right back with more Fashion Is Your Business Live.
Sometimes you gotta sing, da-dee-da-dee-dee-dee, 'cause that's the only way to describe that magical feeling inside. Sometimes you gotta sing, da-dee-da-dee-dee-dee, 'cause that's the only way to celebrate the magic of being alive.
Fashion Is Your Business has more great opportunities to collaborate at other major upcoming events. To explore opportunities to partner, collaborate, or just make sure we connect at these events, email us at podcast@mouthmedianetwork.com. We'll see you there. And now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Fashion Is Your Business Live on location at the New York pop-up restaurant Caviar and Caspia at Spring Place. And of course, we're here with Aliza Licht. Let's continue.
I'd love to start out with a conversation about a shift in roles as digital has taken off, as e-commerce has changed and so on. I know that you're going out to the Chief Marketing Officer, the Transformational Chief Marketing Officer Conference, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds like a reset, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And then we were talking with Emily Culp from KEDS about the way that she's changed her role on the marketing side to basically absorb e-commerce. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about that and what you're seeing as the trends inside of the interplay between marketing and commerce.
So it's a great question. I am going to that conference on Sunday. You make it sound like rehab. I don't think it's rehab.
It is rehab.
So I'm not a CMO. Mm-hmm. And I'm purposely not a CMO because I actually believe, and this is probably why the CMO title is the most fire title in the business, that people can't do both. I think if you're really strong at marketing and communications, you are one person. And if you are really strong at e-com, you're another. So at Alice and Olivia, I have a counterpart who's brilliant, who heads up e-com. We are like this all day long. And I think actually it's a much better strategy than finding the one person who you think is going to be the magic bullet, because I don't think that person exists. I am not sitting here looking at data all day. Like, I have someone who focuses on digital marketing. Like, I am not looking at e-com sales all day. There's someone that does that. I am focusing on overarching brand awareness, marketing, direct-to-consumer, and communications. And I think if you really think about it, and obviously, you know, different budgets and, you know, some companies can only have one person because of budgets. But I really think people have niche expertise, and I think it's better to spread it across a couple people who can work together to really move the needle rather than trying to find, you know, the one CMO. And by the way, so many brands are having a hard time hiring replacements because I don't think the person exists.
A lot of time the CMO can be a good entry point, but I think it's less about e-commerce and even more about general technology too. So they can kind of assess it and then figure out who within the organization might be the right person to take a look at that.
What do you think the point of this conference that you're going to is?
I hope I'll learn something. I find that I don't learn a lot at conferences that are specifically fashion related. So this is much broader than fashion. This is not a fashion conference. I think it is sort of next level marketing. It is focused on digital marketing, but at the same time, it's even inclusive of like TV and video and a whole
other... not just retail.
Not retail, no. It's not a retail conference.
Yeah, to learn, you have to step out of the industry.
It's not a retail conference, no.
So what are you most excited about on the tech side? I know, you know, you're an advisor to Aware, which, you know, uses connected devices or IoT. I'm kind of wondering where your mind is on the overall tech spectrum on how it could be leveraged inside of fashion.
Well, I am completely excited about Aware, not just because I'm an advisor. I'm an advisor because I'm excited about Aware. Mm-hmm. And
do you advise any other companies?
I advise Fashion GPS by Launchmetrics. They just merged with another company and now are called Launchmetrics. I've been advising Fashion GPS since 2003.
Got it.
So I think, you know, with IoT, what is next, and it's going to take really brave brands to be able to understand the potential of this. But essentially what Aware is, it's a Bluetooth low energy smart tag that gets embedded in product. So like Jackie and I could be the same consumer according to a brand because we bought the same blue Sarah handbag. And Jackie is an FIT student, and she saved up all her money to buy this bag. And I'm an executive, and I wear mine maybe once in a few months. She wears hers every day. We are not the same customer. But according to CRM, we are the same customer. Mm-hmm. So essentially, what Aware does is allows you to analyze, as a brand, post-sale behavioral analytics. Now, some of you may be thinking like, ooh, weird, what does that mean? Your phone knows where you're going. If you have Uber on your phone, if you have Facebook on your phone, if you have any single app on your phone knows where you are. So the tag in the product is not GPS. It is an encrypted barcode, by the way, encrypted by Israeli hackers. So super, super high level of hacking there. And what it does is once you sort of say, yes, this is my handbag, it now understands what happens with that handbag. So if you're a brand and you see that a handbag that someone bought is sitting in their closet for months, well, okay, why? What's wrong with it? Is it too heavy? Are they over it? Do you want to offer them something new? So it's this one-to-one communication that a brand has never been able to have with a consumer based on how they use the product. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, it doesn't exist in the world. So this is a technology that Aware is working intensely right now with several brands. They're under NDA, but several brands to really bring this to market. It is in market in Israel right now with the biggest e-commerce retailer. And to me, that's like the brand side, that's amazing. And then on the consumer side, so it is B2C also, the consumer side, it is fashion frequent flyer. So the more you wear the brand's product, the more you get rewarded. It could be in something that's promotional, like a discount. It could be something that's an experience.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what the brand gives the consumer is bespoke. So it's whatever. And also interspersed with, you know, maybe, you know, one-to-one communication from the designer or whatever the brand wants to reward the consumer for wearing it. So it's basically leveraging consumers, yeah, people who pay their hard-earned money on your product.
To actually use the product.
As ambassadors.
Yeah.
As opposed to paying bloggers who don't buy your product.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, if you put back your digital, your communication hat back on and you say, okay, from a brand's perspective, this I could leverage these insights in what regard? So forget about even the reward stuff, but to identify how people are using your product or where they're using your product, how are you then going to tailor your communication strategy to accommodate?
So for example, a case study that we did in London with an evening bag was actually worn during the day. So e-commerce or marketing may be like, oh, we should pair this evening bag with like a cocktail dress from like an e-less perspective, but
what made it an evening bag?
It was a clutch, like a beaded clutch.
That's it? So that's an evening bag?
Yeah, we're going to day? I mean,
you can only fit so many things for the evening.
I can't. I mean, I have a wallet. It's got everything I need in it.
Honey, you are not the consumer.
No,
I'm
totally get
here.
It. I mean, but no. They're not the consumer that you're talking about because they're wearing it during the day.
No, but the point
why
is,
are they calling it an evening bag? Because it's a clutch.
You know when a company makes a line list in their mind, design is this is an evening bag. This is what they declared it as.
And then they don't listen to the customer at all anymore.
It's gone. They don't know because they don't have this technology. So basically, with this smart tag, they now know the consumer is wearing it to work. So instead of showing them little black dresses that they can wear with this evening clutch, they're going to show them what they can wear to work with it. Or let's say this consumer is constantly going to museums. We can identify different types of consumers. So you have like in these multiple case studies we've done, like you have like the jet set traveler, or you have like the working mom because you know she's going to school every day, or you have the student who's going to FIT every day. All these people could have the same product, but they shouldn't be marketed to in the same way. And right now, it's a one-size-fits-all marketing strategy because you have no idea what happens to your product when it leaves the store.
Coincidentally, Aware is also part of the New York Fashion Tech Lab, so I've gotten to see a little bit more about what the technology can do and how it's just the beginning.
Yeah.
So just the bags is kind of the start, but there's so much more you can do.
So, this is fascinating to me because I know that design houses that are in the luxury category, they rely or their consumers rely on the designer to tell them what's trend, to tell them what's going on and how they're going to use things, right?
That's the whole shift that's happening. Yeah.
Do you see this happening across retail, like even including the luxury side?
I do, because I think for luxury, it's going to be about the experience you get by using this. So whether it is that you get flown to, Champagne by a French brand because you are...
I've had champagne from Champagne.
That's great. I'm happy for you.
Back to Aliza.
I actually don't like champagne. I think it's about experience. I think it's about... This is where the brand marketing team comes in because it's understanding... No one's going to know the brand better than the people who work there.
Yeah.
So understanding... What are the jewels that you can give a consumer who is wearing your product all the time? And it's in real time and it's global. So you could literally be like, okay, everyone who's at Coachella right now with X bag, you have access to our VIP lounge. All you have to do is walk in with your bag because the bag is your invitation because the technology knows that you're there.
Yeah.
So it's the future, and I think that between the data the brands get on understanding what happens to the product and the rewards the consumer get, it's like smart loyalty on crack.
I'm into it, like big time. And what I'm really waiting for is what you had mentioned earlier is a consolidation, right? Is some sort of neural net that captures all this stuff that's happening. So if you're talking about this is IoT, and then how does that connect with your messaging capabilities and chat, which I'm curious
to
hear.
It is within
it's
the
both.
App. It's all within the app. And by the way, it can be white labeled SDK for the brand, or Aware has an app too. But you're chatting. You can literally send push notifications, like if you're at Coachella, like step into our Wi-Fi lounge. Or you could be like, hey, if you wear your bag today, because it also detects tribes, so it understands who's friends based on the tags being together. So you can say to a group of students, like, if you all wear your whatever bag to Starbucks today, you get X amount of points. Mm-hmm. So there's gamification as part of this too.
So we're closer and closer to figuring out how to bridge digital and physical spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an interesting step. I'll leave aside all the privacy concerns that I have.
Well, you have a phone, right?
So
he uses it to make phone calls only.
Yeah.
Literally.
That's what phones are for.
Yeah. Right?
special situation.
Yeah. He's a special location on your phone.
So, usually I leave my phone off or in airplane mode. But still, that doesn't.
Okay, I think he's really specific.
Yeah, that's why I'm leaving aside.
He's one of one.
Yeah. you schedule a call, right? And then you have the call with the rotary dial.
Do you belong friends?
With the rotary dial.
Yeah.
He's my best friend.
He does, but weirdly, none of them have phones. I don't know.
So I'm wondering a little bit about what you see is missing in that space between that bridge of digital to physical.
So what's really interesting, and if you guys saw Business Insider today, the retail apocalypse article.
Yeah, this is the 10th year we've been writing about that.
Yeah, but did you see those stats? So I really think this is a great example of what could actually get traffic into store. So you're it's nothing like Beacon, if that's what you're thinking right now.
No, hell no. Nobody thinks about Beacon anymore.
It's nothing like RFID. It's nothing. I mean, it is not. It is because you don't have to do anything.
Well, I think the role of a store has changed, right? It's not necessarily about driving them into a store for conversion or any of that.
No, but stores want traffic.
They want traffic, sure. That brings us into sensors and how this connects with it, by the way. How are you guys thinking about sensors and connecting it to all these fancy IoT things that you got in your head?
Well, what's really interesting is another aspect of Aware's technology is basically Shazam for fashion. So you literally could just hold up your phone.
Yeah, visual search.
Yeah.
So we were over at NRF in January, and a big theme that we saw there was emotional recognition sensors. You know, just things, or even just demographic based. So like, okay, this is a woman, this is a man, this is approximately how old they are, and grabbing insights. I'm wondering, are you looking into that just yet on, you know, in the physical space? Are you looking at, okay, so now you got somebody into your space, whether it was from digital marketing, advertising, or just store location, whatever. When they're in there now, are you looking at sensor, like, you know, different sensor technologies to identify whom they are? Also, how are you thinking about maybe cameras and, you know, high frequency audio or just pinging people's phones? Like, how are you gathering data or thinking about data and how it could be aggregated in that physical environment to plug into digital?
I mean, I think, you know, there's a million things you can do, and that's certainly one of them.
There's a
lot.
I think that's so much, far beyond
the fashion industry's capability right now, because we can all talk about how that's going to happen.
And it probably won't be tested in fashion. It'll be tested.
I mean, I'm not going to mention any brand names, but I've worked, obviously, with several in the past. The fashion industry is so afraid, in general, to make a mistake that they test nothing. So I think there's a few brands that are like, you know what, we're just going to go for this. If it doesn't work a week later, we don't care. To me, that's the right mentality. You have to just test stuff. So I think that's an expensive proposition. And I think until a brand understands what's going to really come of that, I think AI, more intuitive sort of back end on e-com and understanding, like, if you're shopping based on your IP, like, what your habits are, that I think is going to become, it's going to be more
happening
rather than like them knowing that I'm Aliza Licht when I walk into a store
and
what my last purchase was.
I just bought something from a company called Chubbies. They do like swimsuits
never
and stuff.
Buy from a company called
Chubbies.
Oh,
they're hilarious. The box.
Swimsuits?
The box had a cowabunga on it. It was amazing. It was so good.
Wait, you're trying to sell swimsuits you're called Chubbies.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a cowabunga marketing strategy.
It's so good.
They sold one.
They're super short. Yeah, yeah. They're like 5 inches or 7 inches. Like, I'm going
to
be killing
a chubby to me is a mini fur coat. Yeah. So I'm going to go with that version.
But anyhow, what I really appreciate about the experience is it was the first time that they used Facebook Messenger to keep a hold of me after purchase.
Yeah.
And it wasn't in an obnoxious way.
Was it actually somebody or was it bot?
Not sure. And isn't that that's
the point?
The
yeah,
point, that's good.
Right?
Yeah, they did it well if you don't know.
Not terribly sure.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for stuff like that, right? So that was particularly fascinating. We had interviewed Jacqueline Ling of Kik and just talking about how brands, you know, participate in the conversation in the Gen Z category through Kik messaging. How are you guys approaching that arena?
We're not right now, to be honest with you. I think that there was a lot of buzz on that for like a hot minute. And then I think the consensus was that nobody has done it well.
Should check out Chubbies. They're a swimwear line.
Chubbies? I don't know. For me, and we discussed this at South By, I like humans.
Mm. Yeah, at the end of the day, it has to feel, like, authentic.
And by the way, I'm, like, one of those customers. I have a million questions.
Yeah.
You can tell if it's not.
Yeah, like, I need human interaction. In fact, this is a really non-fashion example, but does anyone shop on Wayfair? Okay. So if you have a business account, you're looking at me like, what is that?
On Wayfair. Okay.
You Wayfair home, nope. Home stuff?
Yeah, okay. We do.
Sur La Table.
Okay.
It's actually amazing.
West okay. Elm.
Wayfair is amazing. So if CD2. You have a business account, you have an account executive. And on every web page, and any single product I click on, it says my account executive, Shane, with, you know, Shane's email and phone number right there. It's like any minute of the day, I am emailing Shane and Shane's responding to me like normal human.
Nice.
I prefer that over a bot. What is, I mean, what? It's like do Judy
you,
Jetson.
Do you know for
is
sure that
it's
Shane?
It's Shane. It's a real email. I've called Shane.
It's a real phone number.
I know you're, I know you're not people. Trusting. Yeah. I know you're not trusting.
The four people with a similar voice, all of which are Shane at different shifts. Yeah.
Trust me. When Shane is sending me like pictures of the snowstorm where he is, it's Shane. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really sophisticated bot.
Yeah, it's really sophisticated.
It goes above and beyond.
I don't know. I also think like stores that do really well in clienteling, there's a reason. It's because you're making a personal connection with that customer, and then you create loyalty. You're not creating loyalty with a bot. I don't care
but
how good
be,
your bot is.
You could be bridging that communication, though, with the
yeah,
bot.
Yeah,
there are places
for
it.
I think
it works,
there
yeah.
are places for it. I think, you know, the Amazons of the world, sure, but I think not for, like, a boutique brand. I think there's
right.
still a level of
clienteling. Yeah, and it depends on luxury, too, where you're paying for more service, and it comes
yeah,
back to service.
Totally. Totally. Like, okay, so we just got a car.
Congrats.
Which, by the way, we got the car, thank you, on Friday and got a flat tire Saturday.
Really?
So now the car is not here anymore. However, the person who sold us the car delivered it to our home and then picked it up on Saturday to retrieve it from our garage to get the wheel changed. That's service. That's luxury service. That is not, to me, that's why you pay more. To have that. That's not happening with a bot.
I'd like to pivot quickly to a slightly different subject and talk about the fact that the world's getting smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And we're.
It's the same size, Mark.
It feels smaller to me. Okay.
You're getting bigger. But, that's
all right.
Oh, damn. That's why you have no friends, Rob.
All right, take it outside.
You do know I edit the show, right? What happened to Rob in that episode? He wasn't even in it. So, you know, we're getting closer and closer to our international neighbors.
Yes.
And through, you know, digital technology and the internet and all those sorts of things, we're able to have conversations more and more. And consequently, other countries are able to have more and more access to U.S. markets and vice versa. So the question is, as this is ever increasing and growing, what's happening is that's got to be changing the story. That's got to be making your job more complex. Mm. It's got to be even more considerations because of the different kinds of images that need to be used, the different languages you need to worry about, even different currency and just so many different aspects, especially as countries like, you know, South Korea, for example, just rising up and rising up in the fashion and beauty spaces becomes more and more of a consideration. We got to really pay attention to that.
Right.
And then you have the issues of places like China that, you know, Instagram can't penetrate in China, and they have their own solution there, like with Little Red Book and so forth. So my question is, how do you navigate this very complex, changing story scape?
Well, I think for one, you know, most fashion brands that have global business have operators in those countries and sales teams and marketing teams and communication teams. So that's how we navigate it, because we have people in the region who are working on social media, who are saying, okay, this post doesn't work for us. We need it this way. You know, how do we translate it? Does that translate? Is the tone going to work? You know, really understanding that. But in case anyone here works for a brand who doesn't have that kind of infrastructure on the global landscape, there is a company called DataWords that actually does a lot of major brands, including LVMH and Cartier and got a slew of other brands, Benefit. And they basically do that for you. So they represent over 60 countries on their team. So they're speaking in the language, and they basically have social media teams that work on that content.
But even with resources like that or having a big infrastructure, from your chair, you really got to be thinking about the overall story. So the brand doesn't think of 60 different stories they're going to tell. There's still one primary story that's being told that gets then dissected into different versions of the story depending on the individual culture. So how are you thinking about that, even in terms of coming up with the primary story, knowing the ways it's going to be dissected?
So you don't cater, you don't develop, you don't design for the world. Your brand DNA is your brand DNA. If a brand that starts in New York is now in 800 doors worldwide, there is a piece of New York that is going with that. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to erase that. You just need to be clever about the way that you position it so that it can make sense wherever it is.
Or how they all work together, the different markets.
But like that brand is selling there because they want a piece of you in New York. That's New York is what sells, right? Or France is what sells, or whatever country you're talking about. So that has to go with it. And I think really the core essence of the brand DNA is the fixed quotient in that equation, where that has to stay the same, and then you extrapolate out.
Excellent.
Fixed all right, quotient. Perfect. Solid.
On that excellent, solid note, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have more with Aliza Lick and Fashion Is Your Business Live, and it will be our third segment, which anyone listening to the show knows means off-the-grid questions, where we get a little more personal. We'll do all that right after this. See you soon. So lately, you've probably noticed that Mouth Media Network, which produces Fashion Is Your Business and American Fashion Podcast, has been premiering a number of really cool new podcasts. But we have a different kind of show, a really exciting new program that we're going to be premiering in the middle of April, April 15th, and it is called 16 Weeks. And we hope that you will listen to it and subscribe. You can sign up to be notified when the show launches at 16weekspodcast.com. Take the next minute to go on a journey with us, because here's a sneak peek at 16 Weeks.
Do you remember what we used to say about running?
Oh, somebody bigger had to chase you.
Exactly.
I'm BJ Smith, and that's exactly how I felt about running most of my life. That was until one fall day in 2011. I was chasing my son in the backyard when something had to change. This was the beginning of my journey to becoming a runner. One that would take me from couch to marathon in less than 2 years. Now I'm setting my sights higher. This is 16 Weeks, a new podcast from Mouth Media Network, following me on my journey to get into shape while keeping up my obligations at work and still being there for my family. And I'm not doing it alone.
My name is Keith Smart. I won a silver medal in Beijing.
I'm a sport and exercise psychologist at ECU.
Coach athletes all over the world.
I'll talk with experts about challenges all runners face, like figuring out how to make time to run, what to eat, and how to train.
You got so dehydrated. Your heart rate went up and it felt like you were working so hard.
Everything's trainable, whether it's run form, strength, that's all trainable. And so is our thinking.
Subscribe now to 16 Weeks on iTunes, Google Play Music, or wherever you find great podcasts. Together, we can do this.
There's a man of mystery that's roaming through the land. Oh, far and near you hear of him, he's found on every hand. City, town, and village knows of him by now. There's a way to recognize him, let me tell you how. When your path at midnight dark by the graveyard.
Welcome back to our final segment of Fashion is Your Business. On location at the New York pop-up restaurant Caviar Kespia at Spring Place, we're here with Aliza Licht, and it's our final segment, which means, of course...
And now, it's time for Questions Off the Grid with Fashion is Your Business.
That's right, off the grid questions, where we get a little more personal in nature. Questions, frankly, off the grid. We have no idea the questions we're going to ask. We have no idea what our co-hosts are going to ask or the order they're going to be asked. We solve that by a spin of our massive prize Wheel of Grid Destiny, and I'll spin the wheel, and whoever's name comes up will determine the order of the questions. All right, so I'm going to spin the wheel, and the first question is from Rob.
All right. I like to ask a little bit about childhood and where people came from.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is, can you go back and recall what was an instance where you made a decision to follow a certain path that came from a desire to please somebody else? And what was the first instance you remember where you decided that, you know what, this time it's all me?
Well, I think we actually spoke about that in the beginning. It was, I didn't choose to be pre-med because I wanted to please my parents, although I knew it would please them. But I also chose not to please myself. And, you know, one of the tenets in the book is really like, you have one life, like many chances, but one life. So who are you going to please, yourself or other people? And I truly believe that, you know, people can always start over. It's going to be hard, but you can start over. So I chose to start over in college and, you know, basically that's, I guess, the answer to your question.
Well, what's the first time?
What was the first time?
Yeah.
So that was in college, really.
So up until then, just lockstep.
I'm type A. I'm really quite strategic. And I also am very I have blinders on in the sense that like I've never cared what other people do. Like even like I'll never forget when you came on PR Girl, like people would be like, oh, are you following other people? I'm like, I don't follow anyone on social media because I don't want to see what they're doing. I don't want it in my headspace. I just do my thing and I go with my gut. So that's sort of me.
All right. I'll give the wheel another spin. And the next question comes to me. So I'm telling you it did. And my question is, you talked about getting a new car.
Yes.
So in traveling, and it doesn't have to be in your car, but it could be, what is the most unfortunate thing that ever happened to you when you were traveling? And what is the most extraordinary thing that you ever experienced when you were traveling?
Okay. Such an easy question, because literally the worst thing that's ever happened to me was when Donna and I and Patty, my former boss, we went to Sex Jandel in Maryland, which I think is now closed, to do a show. And it was a blizzard. And Donna was like, basically all the planes were grounded and I had to get back to the city. And she was like, don't worry, we'll go on my plane. And I'm like, but the planes are grounded. Why would we go on your plane if the airport doesn't think it's safe to fly? Like, why would we do that? She's like, it's fine. They're just overcautious. And I'm like, I'm going to take Amtrak. Like, I am not going to, thank you, but no thank you. So I go with Peter Spiliopoulos, who was the head of design at the time, and this other guy, Anthony, who's the fashion director. And I'm in, just picture it, I'm in like 4-inch yellow crocodile pumps, black wide leg pants, black bodysuit. I'm decked to the nines. I have my overnight bag. We're super late. We're running through the train station and I have to get the tickets. And I cannot get the tickets out of the machine. And they're literally closing the gates. And Anthony says, give me your bag so you can run faster. So I give him my bag, including my handbag. Big mistake. And they run through and I'm still getting the tickets out of the machine. And then I get the tickets out. And the Amtrak guy is closing the steel doors. And he's like, I'm sorry, you can't go past here. And I'm like, my friends are on the train. They have my handbag. They have my luggage. Like, I have to get on this train. He's like, no, I'm sorry. The train. And the train is pulling out of the station. Now I have no wallet, no phone, no anything. I am hysterically crying. I am sweating profusely. And I also can't run because I'm wearing yellow alligator 4-inch heels. So he was such an asshole. So I'm like paralyzed. And I stand there and then, just because, you know, you got to love stupid people, he then walks away. So I'm like,
peace. Yeah.
I throw down the stanchions. I literally break through the door. I run onto the track. The train is like 25 feet out of the station. And I start screaming, stop the train. And then everyone on the train starts screaming, stop the train. Yes. And then they stop the train. And I got on.
Yes.
And I literally was like, I have never been, I mean, I feel pain telling this story because that's how traumatic it was. And I got on the train and I was literally dripping in sweat. I mean, soaking wet. And I literally, right then and there, I stripped down naked. I didn't care who I was in front of. I changed into my pajamas because all I wanted to do was, like, be in fetal position, comfortable in the train. And I was barefoot. And I walked through Penn Station barefoot. I was like, I cannot put those shoes on again. That is my worst travel nightmare.
And now, how about your best?
We need to balance this out now. What is a wonderful travel moment that really sticks out, a special moment?
I mean, is there a wonderful travel moment? I feel like every time you travel, it's a nightmare. I mean, when you get there, it's great. I mean, I think any time, you know, with my family is amazing. But honestly, staycations are amazing, too. I think it all depends on who you're with. I generally am not a good traveler. I don't like to travel, and I have a lot of travel this month.
You're
starting
talking
Sunday,
to the right guy right now. We had this conversation today, actually.
I would never go anywhere. I really don't care to see anything.
We literally had this conversation earlier.
I was actually like, how do you even live like this?
Staycation, you and me. Here we go. Yeah. All right, so another spin of the wheel, and it magically comes to Jackie Troublecock.
So this is an easy one, but we talked about New York, and what is your most favorite thing about living in New York? And now that you said you like staycations, I'm sure that's even easier, but
I mean, I think it's really the pulse of it and the energy of it, and I also think the toughness of it. So I am not obviously not a shy person. But also I'm very tough, and in the sense that, like, things don't really rattle me. I'm not sensitive. You can tell me that my idea sucks. I really don't care. So for me, New York is all about that kind of teaching toughness, in the sense to make you stronger, better, faster, smarter. So to me, I think the pulse of the city kind of really gives that to everyone, to sort of like have to keep up, to do more, to be better. And I think that's why people come here. And I think also just that you're anonymous in New York. You know, you can be anyone or anything. You could be friends with anyone or everything. No one cares. No one cares. And I think that's the beauty of it. But also I'm from New York, so, yeah. You know, I'm biased, I guess.
And one final spin of the wheel, and magically, somehow, it comes to Pavan.
It could have gone on three other people. It came to me in order. That's pretty good.
I don't know how it happened, Pavan.
Magic.
I'm wondering, so looking back at childhood as well, is a situation where you used your communication skills to get yourself into a unique situation and then have to get yourself out of a unique situation?
Well, I would say I'll change it a little bit. My communication skills used to be my biggest obstacle. Because if you guys haven't, I assume you haven't read my book, but I was a stutterer growing up. Mm-hmm. So I was the person who would beg my parents to write me a note as to why I can't get up in front of the class and give a book report. And this went on.
How did you get over that?
So I went to a speech pathologist, but also I think confidence building. Like, my parents were really incredible in that sense. Like, I never knew that I had a speech impediment until, you know, it was literally in third grade reading class, and the teacher calls, you know, when they would call on you to read a paragraph. And I had this wooden bracelet, like this beaded bracelet on, And she was like, okay, Lisa, go read. And I couldn't. So I was like pulling the bracelet, because I was getting really nervous that I didn't know what to do because I couldn't read it. And she was like pushing me and it broke and the beads went everywhere. And I started hysterically crying. And she's like, I don't understand why you can't read. And I didn't know why, because my parents never, it was just never discussed. Like, I guess, you know, I had never read out loud or whatever the case may be. So that started in third grade. And, you know, it was a lot of teasing and a lot of, you know, there's constantly a situation. Okay, everyone go around, say your name. Okay, read out loud. Okay, yeah. Present this, present that. And, you know, honestly, if you can't get up in front of people and speak that way, especially, anyone, it's nerve-wracking when you're little, let alone if you have a speech impediment. So that continued through college, to be honest. And it wasn't so much a stutter as much as it was that I would talk myself into thinking things like, oh, I can't pronounce vowels. So that would be like a thing. And I'd be like, oh, but my name starts with a vowel. So if you were like, what's your name? I'd be like, silent. And they'd be like, okay, what's your name? So it was a real thing. So to go from that.
Yeah, how did you break through that?
I think just therapy, you know, I had amazing doctors, and also just becoming comfortable in my own skin. So eventually, I mean, there are still moments where like I might get nervous and like pause if someone's like, what's your name? I might have that minute of panic that I would maybe do that again. But to go from that to, you know, doing a TEDx talk or speaking, you know, in front of thousands of people, it's kind of a long journey. So I think that communication and then, of course, to end up in communications is kind of the irony of it all.
Well, did that lend towards your decision to be anonymous with DKNY
no,
PR Girl?
God, no, no, no.
Okay.
No, that was purely because we didn't want to highlight anyone.
Sure.
Maybe that journey is your best travel story.
That is a great travel story. It really is.
Wow.
All right. And it's necessary, would you like to offer any final thought for our audience? It could be reflecting on this conversation or perhaps on the industry or just your own work.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that, you know, I don't know how you guys are. I assume you're just like me. Monday morning, you wake up and you're like, why am I doing any of this? Like, why am I not on a beach in like Bali or somewhere?
Because you don't want to travel there.
True. And I think that what is really exciting or what keeps me going every day is really the aspect of collaboration. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I believe most in is team building. And it's something that I take a lot of pride in. So I think, you know, when we talk about our professional lives, or we talk about our goals, or we talk about, you know, what we need to do in our lives, I think, you know, to me, collaboration is the most important ingredient of all of that. So I encourage everyone to wake up tomorrow and just be a better collaborator than you were today, because when you collaborate, amazing things happen.
And Aliza, how can people connect with you?
You can tweet me at Aliza Licht.
All right. And that's AlizaLicht.
Yes.
All right. What a pleasure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. You guys asked great questions. And thank you all for being here. It was really fun.
Yeah. All right. That is it for this episode of Fashion Is Your Business Live. A big, big thank you to Aliza Licht, the Executive VP of Brand Marketing and Communications at Allison Olivia by Stacey Bendett. Thank you very much for joining
pleasure.
Us.
It was a pleasure.
And also a thank you to Jackie Troublecock for joining us as a guest host. Thanks a lot, Jackie.
Thank you.
All right, that's it, everybody. And also one more big thank you to our hosts. Of course, the incredible New York pop-up restaurant, Caviar and Caspia at Spring Place. Thanks for hosting us. This is really a beautiful, beautiful spot. For Puvin Ball.
Shake it easy.
And Rob Sanchez.
Good night, y'all.
I'm Mark Rako. Thanks for listening, everybody. We really do appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing you next time. That's it for today. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
This has been Fashion Is Your Business. To suggest guests or content for the show, or to become a sponsor, email us at podcast@mouthmedianetwork.com. Keep up with the show on social media at Fashion Biz Show. That's Fashion B-I-Z Show. Episodes available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, along with our website, fashionisyourbusiness.com. Produced by Mouth Media Network. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. No portion of the episode may be distributed or published without the express written permission of the producers. This is your announcer, Peter Coleman. Thanks for listening.